I wouldn't really believe what comes out on CNN or ABC or CBS just because of the track record.
We're only interested in using international law when it suits our interests. That's very dangerous in the United States because we're seen as hypocrites.
Our children's mental health is less than that of other countries because these politicians care more about their bombs than our babies.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, April 9th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A reporter from Al Jazeera TV insists the U.S. deliberately targeted his colleague. A peek through the lens of a war photographer in northern Iraq. And U.S. Congressman John Conyers says some Republicans are poised to pass a Patriot Act, too. Those stories and more on tonight's Peace Watch. But first, these news headlines.
With headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Janaki Lafis.
And I'm Adriana Raudzans. In a briefing today covered by the Associated Press, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld declared, quote, Saddam Hussein is now taking his rightful place alongside Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, Ceausescu in the pantheon of failed brutal dictators, and the Iraqi people are well on their way to freedom. Meanwhile, looking toward the future, Tony Blair telephoned French and Russian Presidents Jacques Chirac and Vladimir Putin. Reuters notes the leaders agreed that the international community would need to work together in order to facilitate an Iraqi government run by its people. Despite having secured much of Baghdad, U.S. forces, according to wire reports, still battle on, now fighting loyalists in Saddam Hussein's desert hometown. The BBC writes that the body of Vach Arslanian, a Red Cross worker missing since Tuesday, was found.
Two Pakistanis living in Denver, Colorado, and accused of terrorist connections, were released on bail yesterday. The judge declared that the FBI failed to provide sufficient evidence to prosecute the men. Adriana Routsens reports.
The Joint Terrorism Task Force was dealt a blow yesterday when U.S. District Judge Louis Babcock of Colorado ordered the release of two Pakistanis alleged to have terrorist connections. Irfan Kamran and Sajid Nasir were not indicted on charges of terrorism, but rather on suspicion of harboring an illegal immigrant. Only later, once the men were in custody, did federal prosecutors request that they be held without bail for potential terrorist connections. This Denver case reflects a nationwide pattern in which defendants are charged with any possible crime and then incarcerated without bail on charges of terrorism. Nasir's defense attorney, David Lane, elaborates.
The FBI will go talk to immigrants who are from the Middle East. They will look for any conceivable violation, traffic or otherwise, whatever. They will indict these guys and then seek deportation, and that's racism.
For Free Speech Radio News in Colorado, I'm Adriana Raudzans.
Meanwhile, in Norway, another accused terrorist has been released. Patrick Beckett reports.
Faraj Ahmad Najmuddin is better known as Mullah Krekar. Krekar was released late last week by Norwegian authorities who were investigating him for his role in planning acts of terrorism. An appeals court decided to release Krekar after reviewing the case. The Norwegian National Authority for Investigation and Prosecution appealed his release to the Norwegian Supreme Court, but today the Supreme Court upheld the decision to release him. In a meeting with the Norwegian Foreign Minister, Colin Powell expressed concern over Krekar's release. U.S. authorities have linked Mullah Krekar and his group Ansar al-Islam to al-Qaeda. Patrick Beckett in Copenhagen for Free Speech Radio News.
Senior United Nations officials have joined in the chorus of protest over U.S. military strikes that killed journalists in Baghdad. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
Koichiro Matsuura, Director General of the UN's Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, today called on the belligerents in Iraq to respect international law and avoid targeting journalists. In a statement in Paris, home of UNESCO, Matsuura recalled Article 79 of the Protocol or Amendment to the Geneva Conventions, which states that journalists carrying out professional duties in conflict areas must be regarded as civilians. Matsuura stressed the vital role of journalists in safeguarding freedom of information in difficult and dangerous conditions. The Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and Amnesty International have all condemned the killings, saying the locations where journalists worked were well known to U.S. military planners. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The United States is to supply Nigeria with naval ships, but some question the motives behind the decision. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The United States Embassy in Nigeria says the ships are meant to protect Nigeria's fishing interests and check illegal oil bunkering. But human rights groups say The program is meant to protect America's oil interests in the Niger Delta and the Gulf of Guinea. Isaac Osuaka is regional coordinator of Oil Watch Africa. He says United States' interest in the Niger Delta and the Gulf of Guinea is part of a larger American plan to control global oil.
We have also seen in other places, like in Nigeria, for instance, and more generally around the Gulf of Guinea, that the United States is expanding their military presence in the oil-rich Gulf of Guinea, specifically to protect, you know, to have some control over oil supply.
Communal agitation in the Niger Delta has put the activities of United States oil companies like Chevron Texaco under threat, occasionally forcing them to suspend their operations in the area. The Nigerian Navy is poorly equipped to protect the interests of Western oil companies operating in the Niger Delta. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonike Lafis.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Shortly before 8 a.m. in Baghdad yesterday, the Al Jazeera satellite building was bombed by U.S. forces, killing journalist Tariq Ayoub and injuring a cameraman. Minutes later, U.S. artillery damaged the offices of Abu Dhabi TV, trapping 30 journalists in the debris. Several hours later, on the same day, the Palestine Hotel that housed international journalists was fired upon by a U.S. tank, killing two journalists. According to OneWorld.net, the Pentagon's response from Central Command was that, quote, non-embedded journalists operate at their own risk and that U.S. forces bear no responsibility for protecting journalists operating independently in Iraq, unquote. The Pentagon defended its attack of the Palestine Hotel by saying that their forces came under fire by snipers in the hotel. But Amnesty International says if the hotel had demonstrably been used for military purposes, it should not have been attacked by a tank shell, clearly incapable of careful targeting in this case. Amnesty went on to say that the Palestine Hotel was protected under international humanitarian law. Two major international press watchdog groups have denounced the U.S. strikes that killed the three journalists and wounded many more because Al Jazeera's facilities in Kabul had been bombed during the conflict in Afghanistan in 2001. Al Jazeera had provided the U.S. forces with the satellite coordinates of its office in Baghdad, plus the code of its signal to the satellite transponder, hoping to avoid attacks without success. From Doha, Qatar, Peace Watch spoke with Hassan Ibrahim, the senior producer for Al Jazeera, about the journalists killed and these separate attacks.
There was a press conference yesterday, and the evidence basically tells of a different story than the official story told by CENTCOM. Those people were basically reporting from Baghdad, and someone wanted them silenced, basically. It was getting more embarrassing. The civilian casualties are very high. The situation is very, very serious. And as you see, even today, with the fall of Baghdad, the looting and the revenge killings and all that, they didn't want a lot of press, especially from the Arab media present, basically to report that. And I guess we're very angry and very upset that our colleague and the other colleagues were killed.
Did you know the colleague from Al Jazeera?
Yes, I sure did. Mm-hmm. His name is Tariq Ayoub, 35 years old, master's in telecommunications, spoke fluent English, Hebrew, Arabic, very well-educated person, a family man, married with a one-year-old daughter, and the only son of his mother. So it was such a travesty, and the family is really, really grieving. We are grieving over his death.
What kind of reporting had he been doing specifically with regard to the war?
Basically, he was stationed on the Jordanian-Iraqi border, and then 5 days prior to his death, was sent to Iraq, to Baghdad, to supplement our team. And he went there, and he basically was doing real hard-cutting reports because he was one of very few journalists who would actually dare and venture into the street, do the stand-up in the middle of the street. He was really, really daring. And someone wanted him silenced. Someone wanted him silenced. I have no doubt about it.
Well, now, was he at the Palestine Hotel when he was killed?
No, he was at Jazeera's office.
At the
Jazeera's office was bombed at 7:15 in the morning, and the Palestine Hotel was bombed 4 hours after that.
Was he the only journalist in that particular office?
No, he was downstairs in the office in the ground floor, and then when the shells started falling, he wanted to rush to the roof of the office to adjust the Jazeera's camera because we have a very good view over the bridges over the Tigris River. And what he did, he was trying to adjust the camera, and there was a British tank on the bridge, and it fired one missile after another after another. They actually made sure that the guy was dead and no camera was standing.
So did your cameras capture any of that?
I think the whole roof was destroyed, not just the cameras.
How is it possible that they would have known that that was an that was a Jazeera television office and therefore targeted it specifically?
Because exactly that was the case. Because it was a Jazeera's office, it was targeted.
And was that widely known that that was a that the Al Jazeera office was located there in that building? And would the British tanks have known that?
It is the most famous office in Baghdad. In 1998, we were the only ones deporting from Iraq. In 1997, we were the only ones in Iraq at all. So, everybody knows where Jazeera's office is. It's the most famous building in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Iraqi officials know it. Foreigners know it. It's near the Ministry of Information. It's clear. There was a press sign on it. I mean, you couldn't mistake it for a military target, to be honest with you.
Reuters News Service reported that the Al Jazeera site in Baghdad is listed in the U.S. Global Position Satellite. Is it possible that the U.S. Global Positioning Satellite is not working?
Ma'am, that wasn't a jet firing in the dark. That was a tank firing in the early hours of the morning, and the sun was clear, blaring. Baghdad is a very sunny place. It's not the Black Forest in Germany, with fog in the morning. That was Baghdad in the morning.
There was some discussion by Pentagon officials that Al Jazeera may be a legitimate target if they were being used by Saddam Hussein's regime to provide quote-unquote misinformation. What's your response to that?
I would say this is a war crime. Even discussing that is a war crime, because when you consider a news agency as a legitimate military target, then I don't know what is the justification for that. I mean, A, I don't believe this whole fiasco, this whole war was justified. B, even if the war were to be justified or accepted, we're just there reporting. We report what we see. That's our motto. We report what we see. And if what we see doesn't appease the Iraqis or doesn't appease the Americans, then tough. That is journalism. You are a journalist and you understand. If I see something, I have to report it. Otherwise, I'm not worthy of being a journalist.
Yes. What kind of impact has this had on you and your fellow colleagues?
Well, my colleagues are very angry. To me, it had more of a personal impact because, I mean, I had a loss like that before. In 1982, I lost my wife in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, 1982, 15th of September 1982. I mean, my wife was killed in front of me. She was a journalist as well. And, just the death of Tariq Ayoub really, really brought it all back. Mm. I mean, that was 21 years ago. Thank God I'm married to a wonderful wife, and I have a son and everything, and I have a daughter from a previous marriage. I'm a stable person. But that death brought it back to me. I just felt so angry, so bereaved, personally.
I know the military people. I'm not a politician. I'm not a military man. I mean, the politicians can have the justifications. The spin doctors can spin whatever they want. All what I see is a dead colleague.
Is this likely to have a chilling effect on the other journalists there in the region attempting to cover this war?
Well, they will be more careful, but they will not run away. As a colleague of mine said, they wanted to silence the witness. When the other witnesses are not running away, we will not run away. I mean, I would go to Iraq in a wink today. If I'm allowed, I will go today in a wink. I mean, it is my duty as a journalist to actually report the truth. And if I can find the, if I see the truth on the side of the Iraqis, on the side of the Americans, on the side of the Israelis, on the side of the Brits, on the side of anybody, it's my duty to report it. I am just a conduit. I just give the viewers what is in front of me. And if I can do that to the best of my ability and with honesty and integrity, then I've done my duty. If I die in the process, then that's the price of being a journalist, I guess.
Are there going to be any legal actions taken, do you think, by Al Jazeera TV as a result of this?
I think the International Federation of Journalists and the National Union of Journalists of England and plenty of other reporters, Sans Frontières, and other organizations are calling for an independent investigation into the incident, and they want legal action. And they want this to be considered a war crime and to bring those responsible to justice. But unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world. You know that.
Yes.
And what is justice to an Arab is not a justice to an American. The yardstick is so different. I mean, there isn't a similar yardstick to me that applies to you on the other side of the Atlantic. There is a totally different yardstick, and I'm not optimistic, to be honest with you. I mean, any investigation would be controlled by the spin doctors, and then probably political negotiations and deals from behind the scenes, and Tariq Ayoub will be forgotten. I will not forget Tariq Ayoub. His colleagues won't, and definitely his one-year-old daughter would not forget him.
Well, we're also seeing reports where many Iraqis or at least some Iraqis are coming out and greeting the troops, thanking them, thanking President Bush for liberating them. What can you...
Well, to be honest with you, I lived in the Arab world long enough and I've seen this happen all the time. A coup d'etat takes place and then from out of nowhere you'll find thousands of cheering crowds and they're filmed on television, and of course this it's good footage. I mean, it will serve the whole world as well. Look at those cheering Iraqis. But do I really know where these Iraqis come from? Are they the Iraqis who are in the camps in Khafji and taken by the Americans with them? Are they the Iraqis from Massoura city near Baghdad who are basically the underbelly of the city? Because as I was just watching something very funny on TV. There was the news that they tightened around the neck of the statue to bring it down broke. So the soldiers on the tank were helping the crowd bring it down the tank while the other crowds were looting the tank itself. So, I mean, it's not funny, but it's farcical. I mean, the whole situation is farcical. There is nothing in this war that really makes me respect the people who perpetrated it or the people who did it, but to the best of my ability, I will maintain my objectivity as a journalist. I report exactly what I see.
Well,
and I cannot speculate. I really cannot speculate.
I have to admit I was watching some of the mainstream coverage last night on CNN, and they were showing where Iraqis were taking the reporters through the prison, a former prison that Saddam Hussein allegedly held people in and tortured them in, and I don't doubt that that happened, but they seem...
Oh, yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that the Iraqi regime committed many atrocities. I mean, that is properly documented and reported by independent observers and independent networks. And I just, if you bear with me, I really, from an Arab perspective, the American mass media lost its credibility in the Arab world just since the coverage of the Intifada and the coverage of Palestine. We saw a very one-sided coverage. That's why, until I see it on the BBC or TV5 Paris or read it in Der Spiegel, I wouldn't really believe what comes out on CNN or ABC or CBS just because of the track record, not because I have less respect for Dan Rather than I have for Zainab al-Badawi of the BBC. It's just that is the track record we've seen from American networks.
Hassan Ibrahim, senior producer for Al Jazeera TV Network in Doha, Qatar. On several occasions since the beginning of the war, U.S. officials have claimed that Iraq is in violation of the Geneva Convention. The administration was outraged when American prisoners of war were paraded on Iraqi TV several weeks ago and grisly pictures of dead coalition forces were broadcast. The Pentagon refuted assertions that the U.S. was also in violation of the Geneva Convention after Allied forces bombed Iraqi television off the air. Military officials stated that the station was under, quote, key regime command and control assets, unquote, and was therefore a legitimate military target. Questions of legality under international law have been raised frequently since the onset of the war. Peacewatch correspondent Matthew Bradley recently attended a conference with international law experts in Washington, D.C., and filed this report.
At this year's conference of the American Society for International Law, debate raged about the legality of the U.S. and British-led war in Iraq. Anne Marie Slaughter, the president of the organization and one of the speakers, took time to share with Pacifica how the debate was framed and some of her own perspective.
One set of issues involves whether the war in Iraq was legal, and there are people who think it was both legal and legitimate, and that includes the U.S. government and the British government, and then there's an enormous number of people around the world who think it was both illegal and illegitimate. In other words, it violated the United Nations Charter, and it is the wrong thing to do morally and politically. The United Nations Charter requires that all nations refrain from the use of force except in self-defense unless authorized by the Security Council. So the question of whether it was legal depends on whether or not you think it was authorized by the Security Council. And the U.S. government and the British government say that there were resolutions that ending the first Gulf War and also that ordered Iraq to disarm and also a similar resolution back in November. And that's enough. That makes it legal. The people on the other side point out that the U.S. and Britain spent 4 months trying to get a second resolution to authorize this particular military action and failed. And the way the charter is written, if you can't get explicit authorization from the Security Council, that means no use of force.
This would make the current war on Iraq an illegal war. Other international law experts have made this point explicitly. Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, in a statement published last Friday, said, "This war is an aggressive war and is flatly contrary to international law. It is neither in self-defense nor has it been authorized by the Security Council. That makes it a crime against peace." Slaughter went on to detail her own opinion that this war is illegal, but in the end might be seen as legitimate, only with significant caveats.
So my own position has been, if in fact U.S. and British troops, when the shooting stops, uncover massive evidence of weapons of mass destruction, sufficient to demonstrate to the world that no matter what Saddam Hussein said, he was never going to disarm voluntarily, and if the Iraqi people in fact welcome the invasion in the sense of welcoming the destruction of Saddam Hussein's government, and if the United States is prepared to go back to the United Nations and ask for a collective role in rebuilding Iraq, then in fact this invasion will have been legitimate, and then our job is to make sure that in the future that there's no gap between what's legal and what's legitimate, that in fact we amend the rules of the Security Council. Of course, there's some very big if.
Do you see any indications of that possibly happening? The U.S. has sent $90 million in the direction of Ahmed Shalabi, who is a convicted corporate criminal, but he's gotten a lot of support as far as possibly being the next prime minister of Iraq or something
right.
like that. So what are the indicators you see as that plays into the scenario you think might find that might, you know, justify this as being legitimate, though it might be illegal?
I think we're actually at a very critical point. The debate within the U.S. government right now and between President Bush and Prime Minister Blair is exactly what role the U.N. should have in helping to establish a democratic Iraqi government. And there are certainly those in the U.S. government who would like to run this as an occupation, which would essentially mean that U.S. Commanders and civilians taking essentially minister positions in the country and then selecting the Iraqi officials who will take over. If the UN is involved, it will mean probably a slower process. It will still mean that U.S. and British troops are there on the ground, of course, and that both U.S. and British officials have an enormous role, but that they actually bring in representatives of other countries, other Middle Eastern countries, which could help a great deal in terms of legitimacy, other experienced UN officials, people who've been in East Timor and in Cambodia and in Afghanistan, to help create a transitional government that involves, of course, the choices of the Iraqi people, but also involves the input from many nations. And that fight is being waged right now. And I predict that unless the U.S. is willing to bend here, even the British may have to defect.
Roger Normand, the executive director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights, recently published a report documenting atrocities of the last Gulf War and questioning reports of certain scenarios happening in the current war. He cites Colin Powell as saying in 1991 that electricity and water facilities were of no military value because Saddam had his own redundant systems independent of the civilian services. The Defense Intelligence Agency published a report before the war that detailed the humanitarian disaster that would occur if electricity and water went out. Then, during the first Gulf War, U.S. forces bombed such facilities. How does such behavior fit into what some might call an ends justifies the means scenario that Slaughter claimed would be legitimate, although already illegal?
I think we will see that we fought this war as cleanly as possible. That is an important criterion of legitimacy. There's no question. We can't go in and claim this is legitimate if we're killing the very people we say we're rescuing.
What do you think of the U.S. position on international law?
Well, it's certainly a mixed picture in the sense that during the Cold War, because the U.S. had a veto and the Soviet Union had a veto in the Security Council, both sides violated the charter periodically because they, when they felt that an important interest was at stake, they didn't go to the Security Council to seek approval because they were convinced that it would be vetoed on political grounds. So, for instance, when the United States invaded Grenada, it did not go to the UN. In the 1990s, the United States went to the United Nations often. I mean, the first Gulf War, Somalia, Bosnia, Haiti. It did not go in Kosovo with NATO. NATO basically went around the United Nations. And then in other areas, such as the World Trade Organization, the United States has been very supportive. That's the good side of the ledger. On the downside, the United States did not sign the International Criminal Court Treaty, even after we had been very important in getting it drafted. We rejected the Kyoto Protocol. We refused to participate in the chemical weapons ban renewal, and we didn't sign the Landmines Treaty. So in the eyes of many people in the world, we're only interested in using international law when it suits our interests. That's very dangerous for the United States because we're seen as hypocrites, upholding the rule of law in word but not in deed. And it's an impression and perhaps a reality that the United States has to address. And it's important that every American make him or herself heard on the question of wanting to go back to the United Nations to work with other countries and not simply to go it alone.
Anne Marie Slaughter, president of the American Society for International Law, speaking with Matthew Bradley from WPFW and the D.C. Independent Media Center. I'm Verna Avery Brown. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. We'll be back in a moment.